Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, we're heading back to the gridiron, talking more football today.
We're going to start off, though, in the bullpen, where we're going to look at the rise of artificial turf in the athletic industry as a whole, but especially in football.
And show note here, there are no bullpens in football.
Well done.
On today's Out of the Park segment, we'll be joined by Michigan State University's sports field manager, Amy Foudy, as we talk about the status of natural turf fields in college football and her success with The Real Thing.
And then we'll finish up in the Tools of the Trade segment, where we're going to actually talk about turf blankets. Not tarps, but blankets. What to use them for, and how best to employ or deploy them. Ha ha
ha. That just makes me feel all warm and fuzzy all over. All of that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And with me again, my trusty sidekick, Teresa Beyer, and co-host and producer of the show on top of all of that.
Greetings and salutations, Mr. Paul.
Well, yes. Well, you know, there's a lot going on in sports turf right now. And Major League Baseball, of course, the playoffs are in full swing across the country. Yeah. My condolences, Teresa. I know you and Larry were not getting to experience the postseason this year. The Twins were so close.
But Brian Dozier was so close. He was really carrying the team.
But my Cubbies are in. That's all I care.
Yeah. You know, I've learned that there's no one more upset about missing the playoffs by that much than the groundskeeper's actual spouse or partner. I feel more bitter than I've ever felt about not getting into the playoffs ever.
I can seem to recall those same feelings by my former wife, as a matter of fact.
I don't know what it is. It's just, anyway.
Well, my Cubbies and the Mets are duking it out for the title of championship of the National League right now, and the Royals and Blue Jays are fighting it out for the championship for the American League. We'll see who comes out winners. I'm personally, if you want to know my feelings, I'm hoping for a Cubs-Royals World Series myself. Keep it in the center of the country. Teams that haven't been in it that much, not that the other teams have been in it that much either. And actually, that's a good thing about, I think, who's coming up in the playoffs is you got teams that have not been in there constantly, like St. Louis and the Yankees and some of these other teams that are constant winners. Not that I have anything against them. I just like to see different people in the playoffs all the time.
Oh, yeah. It keeps it more interesting. Yeah, you know, may the best guys win, and I like all the teams or – isn't that how Obama put it when he was talking about the NCAA tournament that one time?
I don't know. All I can say is I wish the best of luck to all those guys in the majors who are still busy with the playoff games right
now. Absolutely.
If you've never had a chance to experience it, participating in postseason play is so exciting. And one of the few times you don't want the games to end, you know, especially when your team is playing well. And I remember that from the years that we had playoffs while I was there in 96 and 97, it was the rare occasion where the groundskeeper didn't want the season to end because you were just having so much fun.
Yep, absolutely.
So meanwhile, we're having another football show on deck today, and where we'll talk about how natural turf is kind of disappearing a little bit from the sport of football.
Football.
Yeah, so let's scoot. Shall we?
Let's skedaddle. We're gonna
scoot on over to the bullpen. Shall
mosey
we?
On over to the bullpen.
Place a call out there and see if the righties are ready. So, in the bullpen today, we're talking about how artificial turf is slowly but surely taking over, especially in football. But, you know, we see it also in baseball. You're seeing it a lot in the college level. You're seeing a lot of tournament youth ballparks going to all artificial fields. This is no longer a fad. This is becoming quite the trend. And, you know, I've been talking to quite a few people about it lately, reading several articles about it, and it's kind of amazing as I took a look at it from a college football end. What you see, of course, a lot of the teams are already artificial turf, but more so in the north than in the south.
Yeah,
where you've got of course Bermuda grass growing, which typically tends to give better footing for football than
it plays grass. Just as well when it's dormant as it does when it's alive. In fact, some people will argue that it plays better when it's dormant in some cases.
Thanks to those strong stolons, you're getting great footing in there. And of course, the root system of Bermuda grass is so extensive as well. And, whereas the cool season grasses in the north, you know, at this time of the year, they're getting ready to go to bed. And at this point in time, you're going to be getting, you know, root growth. But the difference in footing compared to down south becomes very apparent very quickly as you get late into the fall and into the early winter. I had a conversation. I was hoping to get Andy McNitt on the show today to talk about this, and he wasn't available, unfortunately, at the time, but we were talking about it, and I have to agree with him. You know, you'll hear people say things like, well, we did it because we're saving money on maintenance, or those kind of things. But that really isn't the truth of why a lot of these are doing it. And Andy McNitt was saying he really feels bad for the athletic directors of a lot of these colleges because there's so much demand for field time for all the different sports that, you know, they've got no choice but to put artificial turf in. When you do the math for the turf versus maintenance wise turf versus grass, I'm not totally sold on the fact that it's cheaper to maintain or whatever. I think by the time you put in all the factors of the cost for renovations periodically for the two types and everything else, and the initial costs of building these fields, I think you might find it's probably pretty even, or maybe even artificial turf has a slight advantage.
Well, and I think that's the key, is that 10 years ago when they first started the really heavy sales pitch on these artificial fields, nobody had done the math. The only math that they saw was, you know, well, this will just cost you, you know, this amount up front and that's it, versus all the money you'd spend every year trying to keep these fields in shape and struggling. Plus, you can have all of these other events on them and make money. But nobody had actually done the math, because why would the artificial salesman do the math? It's not their job.
Right.
So I think it's getting better as we're doing more and more of that math, and we're really starting to see just how many extra events we can and can't put on those fields.
Well, and that's really what it all boils down to. It boils down to how many more events can I have on there if I put artificial turf in? Mm-hmm. That ends up being the deciding factor. You know, when I talked about these all these youth baseball tournament complexes, mm-hmm. are going to 100% artificial turf.
Especially since they play in the summer.
It's just absolutely miserable on the player, but you know, they don't want to have rainouts. They can't afford rainouts because they're doing tournaments, so you only have the people in for a couple amount of days. It's not like you're running a league like I'm doing at my little league complex, where the league goes for 10 weeks and we have room fit in there for rainouts. You know, they've got the people in there for a couple days. You got to get the games in, and they got tired of fighting the battle of natural turf. How does natural turf fight that battle? I'm not sure you can. I just don't think it can be done at this point in time unless you put a retractable dome.
Well, I mean, it's about really sitting down with your management and having them. It'd be nice if there was something that was prepared that would help the turf manager or somebody who cared about having natural turf go through almost a thought exercise of how do we really want to use these fields? What level of safety do we want? What level of usability? Because if we're talking summer months, what level of aesthetics do we want out of these fields? And talking through, look, 7-8 years down the line, this is what an artificial field is going to look and play like, versus 7-8 years down the line, this is what a natural field is going to look and play like. This is what actual money we can make if we schedule this amount of events on this field. Can we actually schedule this many events on the field? I mean, I wish I were the person to do it. I don't think I know enough about it to put that together, but it would be a good step in the right direction, along with, you know, putting the math together.
Yeah. And, you know, with youth, if we go to the youth baseball complexes like I'm dealing with, you know, at our Little League complex, you know, we have fabulous fields. We pump some money into them because we know that's what helps sell the product and gets parents to want to play there because, you know, bottom line, parents want to send their kids to nice facilities to play at. And so, you know, I have over $100,000 budget for my three-field Little League complex. Mm-hmm. Now, about half of that gets eaten up in salaries and wages for my ground crew.
Yep.
But I have because of that, I've got a really good ground crew, very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. I've trained them, worked with them, that kind of stuff. And the amount of events that we put on our fields, those three fields, each of those three fields has over 400 events a year on them. And yet you'd be shocked when you see the condition there, and they're in fabulous condition. And it amazes me sometimes how well they hold up. But not everybody can do that. Not everybody has the money or whatever. And when you've got to put that many events on, and especially in the tournament setting where you have such a limited time, I can understand that. I just I don't like it, but it's a necessary evil, and it's a tough battle for those of us in the industry who take care of fields like this all the time to be able to say, oh, we don't like that. We can't do that. Well, we won't always have the answer to combat that. And in some situations, it's justified that it has to be artificial turf.
Yeah. Yep.
In going back to turn back to football, if you look at, for instance, the Big Ten, which Wisconsin is in, and Minnesota, where you are is in, there's only one team in the Big Ten who's never put artificial turf in their stadiums. Can you name it?
Oh, no, I don't even know who's in the Big Ten.
That's great.
I don't.
Well,
Virginia Tech was not in the Big Ten, and Kentucky certainly was never.
I should know. That's right. That you're not from here.
I'm not a college football fan. I'm a my team fan.
Yeah. I can understand that. Well, for those of you who are guessing out there in the audience, it's Purdue. Purdue has never put in an artificial turf field.
Yay.
Now,
agriculture.
Yes. Now, Michigan State had put in an artificial turf field, and they have since reversed that and gone back to a natural grass field. And here in Wisconsin, we've had several arguments over the decades. Mm-hmm. Every time it's time to replace artificial turf, everybody wants natural turf put back in, and you know, inevitably, before it happens, artificial turf gets replaced in there.
Yeah,
it drives me crazy. You know, schools certainly that have big turf programs, you got to think, you know,
what are you thinking?
Yeah, why exactly? You know, you don't want to,
your support. This is what you're trying to sell as your product. We have a turf program, but we can't actually manage it on our field.
Yeah,
<that's>
exactly
I don't
right.
get that at all. I know it's more than that, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah, but I mean, it's you hope that all the schools that have good turf programs have natural grass football fields, but not all of them do.
No. Many do, but
yeah, many do. Right.
There's a few that don't.
There's a few that don't. And maybe someday they'll see the light, but, it's, you know, it's something we have to live with. Now, whether this trend continues and we see that the continuing build of artificial turf continue, that has yet to be seen. You know, Sports Illustrated just had an article recently about, the best fields in NFL football. And interestingly enough, out of the 30 fields, the top, I think it was 13 or top 12, were all natural grass fields. Now, most of them were in the South. Again, the players prefer that Bermuda grass surface because of the better traction versus the bluegrass. The only two cool season grass teams that got in there were the Broncos at number 7 and the Packers at the number 9. Now, the Packers, keep in mind, they're not a true cool season, a totally cool season grass. They have the DD Grassmaster or the whatever system you want to call it, the Deso grass system, I believe was what it's called.
Broncos had something similar for a while. Do they still have that?
They did, but I think they got rid of that, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I remember Ross talking about that in the past. But yeah, you've got to go down to, I think it's the 13th. Yeah, the Indianapolis Colts are the first artificial turf team that's mentioned there in the top. In the top 30. And now this was done.
And they're indoor. They're not outdoor.
That's correct.
So that also has a bearing on how the playability is perceived.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, they used three criterias for this. They used past player rankings. They used insight from current players. And then they also had details from the groundskeepers themselves also that were used to formulate the rankings. Because Andy McNitt, who does a lot of work with the NFL, pointed out that, you know, not every player plays on every field every year.
Right,
you
or know, plays the same way on the field, or yeah.
Yeah, so you can't just take 1 year's information to make that judgment because, again, not every team plays on every field.
Yeah.
So I found that kind of interesting. But it's certainly, to me, the big thing that stood out was that Bermuda grass was certainly the preferred surface of choice for football players. So there you go.
Yeah.
Me personally, I'll stay here in the north because I'll take care of the bluegrass and take those 3 or 4 months of winter off while you people down there in the south work all year long.
What's this off stuff? These guys have to move snow when they're...
your husband has to move snow. I never had to do that in Baltimore. We had an easy off season, and so we loved the off season. And being up here in the north, that's one of the beauties of having winter take effect. If you're in the turf industry, you've got a much easier off season.
That's true. It is easier. So. Yeah, in some ways. So,
All right. That's enough from the bullpen. Let's get a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back with our what do we call it? Out of the park segment. Thanks. For all of you Diamond Da Vinci's out there looking to extend your budget dollars as best you can, make sure you check out the open box section of the Beacon Athletics website. There you'll find items that have been discontinued in our product lineup, returned lightly used items, blemished product, or product we've used for demonstration. All products are new or slightly used and in great working order and are sold as is. These items can be yours at substantial savings, but there are limited quantities, so act fast when you see something you want. If you wait, the product may be gone. Products can be added at any time, so check the site often. Just go to www.beaconathletics.com and click on Open Box on the green toolbar at the top of our homepage. These hot smoking deals are too good to pass up. Today's Out of the Park segment takes us to Michigan State University, which is nestled in East Lansing, Michigan. And it's on that campus where you'll find Amy Foudy tending to the various athletic fields, including natural grass baseball, softball, soccer, and football fields. Now, Amy's a certified sports field manager, and in 2012, she was awarded the Dick Erickson Award by the Sports Turf Managers Association in recognition for her contributions to the sports turf industry. So welcome, Amy, to the Diamond Da Vinci Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, we love having you here. And for all the listeners out there who don't know your background, Amy, can you give us, the audience, a quick history of your career?
Absolutely. I began working in the turf industry when I was 17 years old. That was about 23 years ago. The first 8 years of my turf career were working on a golf course, working my way up through the golf course ranks, and in 1994, attended Michigan State University, got a two-year degree in turf, graduated in 96, went on to be a golf course assistant superintendent, and then superintendent at that golf course for 2 years. So we did a lot of construction, we did a lot of projects and things, and I learned a great deal about project management and managing a larger staff while I was on the golf course. Then in two in 1990, oh goodness, eight, I began working at Michigan for 5 years. I was on the daily operational side of managing their soccer and football fields, stadium and practice fields. Spent 5 years there. And then in 2003, in December, I came back to Michigan State. Nothing like coming back to your alma mater. And began my 11-year career here. We've renovated every athletic field that I currently manage, as well as the golf practice, varsity golf practice facility. And I also finished up a bachelor's degree in psychology last year that I've been working part-time on for the past 8 years.
Oh, fun.
Is that for crew management purposes?
it's a little bit for that. I always tell people it's never the grass that gives you problems. So
you got that right.
especially at a university, I'm dealing with 7 or 8 head coaches who all have singular needs at their facilities. That they are the most important coaches and programs on the campus, mm-hmm. which, I don't fault them for that. I mean, it's their livelihood, it's their programs. And, I just think, working with administrators, athletic department, university, turf department, our kinesiology department, I do stuff with our folks who do, kinesiology research with athletes.
Oh, cool.
There's a lot of different areas that I'm working at the university besides just dealing with crew and student staffing things, that the psychology degree has really been incredibly helpful.
That's really interesting. Unlike a lot of the groundskeepers we've interviewed on this show in the past, you're our first college one, and you're right. You do wear many different hats compared to a lot of the people we've managed. And
I'm sure Parks and Rec.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's a big difference from when you were in your golf course career, doing what you're doing now. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and we. As we renovate facilities, as we do different things, I know when we renovated soccer about 4 years ago, I went and took a coaching soccer class because I had never played soccer. I wanted to understand soccer better before we build mm-hmm. the field.
Oh, good idea.
There's just so many opportunities to learn. And our head soccer coach at the time taught the class, which, so you get his perspective as you're learning the game as well.
Ah.
It's really unique. And I think that we constructed all of our fields and maintained all of our fields here at a professional level, worst case, semi-professional level. I think our standards here are significantly higher than at a lot of the other schools that I've seen, just because we've been allotted maybe more resources to maintain what we have.
And was it like that when you came, or is that something that you instituted over the 11 years you've been there?
Well, I'm the second athletic turf manager at Michigan State University. The first athletic turf manager that was here for 2 years, and then he retired. And I've been here 11. And, when I first started here, I just started here taking care of the football field and the stadium, the two practice grass fields for football, and an indoor practice complex. So every year I've expanded the areas in which we take care of. And, as we do that, you need more staff, more resources,
sure.
and everything. And, it's been really good. I think a lot of it has to do with just the relationships that you develop and setting expectation prior to taking on new responsibilities.
Well, and I will say that, you know, I was at your field, I don't remember how many years ago it was when we did the last Diamond Pro Toro Beacon seminar.
Yeah.
But I remember walking onto your football field and just was in awe of how perfect it was. And I swear to God, I thought it was, at first I thought it was artificial because it was so perfect. And I was just amazed. And I don't know if I've seen a better football field than that one. And I'm not feeding you a line. I'm serious about that. You could do an incredibly beautiful job out there. Now, you've had a really heavy front half of this season. You've had, what, 4 or 5 home games right off the bat, right?
Ooh.
Yes, we had 4 home games in a row, and we had 3, the equivalent of 3 home football games worth of scrimmage plays.
Wow.
Out there prior to that. So we've essentially had 7 games already in our season.
And how has the field fared?
It's faring pretty well. You know, it's starting to get a little worn, a little thin, especially on the 30s. You know, a lot of punting, a lot of run game.
Sure.
But, you know, when it comes to, you know, that I think that you have to sit down initially with your coaches. And, you know, I'm really fortunate that I report to the deputy athletic director here at Michigan State. I don't report to an assistant athletic director who reports to an associate athletic director who reports to, you know, I have a direct line to the person that I need to.
Perfect.
To make the right decisions. And you know, that puts me in the chair with the head coach, and we discuss right off the bat, okay, what are your expectations? What do you need out here? How can we work together to do this? And, you know, Coach D'Antonio is just an incredible, incredible person, besides being just an amazing football coach. And he asked me, you know, what can I do? What can my staff and I do so we have the best all the time? And it was great. We laid out the parameters for his expectations, what I needed to meet those expectations. And, you know, we went from there. And I tell you what, I've used that blueprint with all of our coaches to get us where we need to be because, you know, when you're all on the same page, you're all foraging together forward to build a program, we've just found that I think that's been some of the secret to our success here in Michigan State Athletics, just that teamwork.
Hmm. Now, does your football field host anything else besides, you know, the football games and the scrimmages that you guys have?
Yeah, we do some things time to time. You know, we've hosted, we had a U2 concert here.
Oh, that's right.
Excuse me, 3-4 years ago. We had a wedding in Spartan Stadium this year. We've done lots of commercials, lots of media stuff in here, camp, recruiting visits. Yeah, we do, anything that won't be incredibly impactful on the grass, we try to encourage those activities for whatever reason, whether it's fundraising, recruiting, things like that. We don't do very much else because the weather in East Lansing is just not the most favorable conditions to grow natural grass in.
Sure. But it doesn't sound like you do an overabundance of those types of things compared to what I hear from a lot of other facilities.
Right. I mean, we have this discussion every year about should we rent out our facilities.
Mm. Sure.
And, you know, it's always really interesting, you know, to me, okay, here is our standard that we need to have for our programs, for our student athletes. Okay, so if you want to have another 60 baseball games on the baseball field, okay, this is what I feel I need in terms of staff, supplies, you know, time to renovate, time in between uses. You know, we try to calculate all that in, and when you start adding those costs up, it just doesn't make sense for us to host these things under our current philosophy. Now that, as we all know, things change. And, but, you know, I have a very small staff. And, you know, we have, I have one full-time person. And his job is basically to take care of the football fields. He's my right-hand man. Then I have another person who's who's full-time for me. That this is the first time I've had a second full-time person in all the years that I've been here.
Wow.
So, but 3 months a year, he's going to be taking care of the practice indoor facilities for me so that we don't have to hire students and stuff like that. And I'm sure we'll discuss the heating systems on baseball and softball. So I need to have somebody here in February when we start turning the heat on.
Yeah.
So, you know, things are evolving and changing. And then after that, I have a seasonal person. And that, I mean, the four of us make up the core for all the areas that we take care of.
So,
and then I have part-time students after that.
Do you get much field time because it's a small staff, or do you still find that because of your position, you're doing a lot more management, office-level management, out of curiosity?
We kind of joke. I tell them I'm their glorified secretary. Take care of paying bills, sitting in meetings. You know, I take care of all the dirty
work.
Front office stuff, right? Yeah. For them, you know, sitting down looking, like today I was sitting down looking at designs for the new indoor golf practice field or practice golf green that we're putting in. So they get the coolest job. Like, I ask them every week what they need, I buy it, and then they just go out to the fields and do it. So
that's great.
They have just the coolest jobs.
They're very lucky. Do you miss being outside? Do you miss being out on the field?
I do sometimes, but I try I try to block some time with all of them during the week. And if I get an opportunity, I try to get out and do some training. Like if we have new students, you know, I'll try to go out, teach them how to mow, teach them how to do irrigation work, teach them how to do work on the reels. Like, I try to jump in where I can be really useful, but that I can jump out of it too, where I'm not specifically tied to any one thing.
Well, let me jump subjects now and kind of talk about something we were talking about earlier before we got to your interview, and that's about the spread of artificial turf throughout college football. And you're one of the stadiums that's been able to hold that at bay. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Michigan State at one time was artificial turf.
That's
and they converted
correct.
To back to natural turf. Yeah.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, there's, when you look at a lot of college football now, there's not much left of natural turf. Are you ever, since they converted back to grass, has there ever been a discussion to go back to turf? Or have they pretty much left, has there been no discussion about that at all?
Well, when I first started here, it was two seasons after the field
conversion. Yep.
So years after that conversion, and I was pretty much told that the field wasn't really performing as they had hoped it expected, and that was from a university administration standpoint.
Uh-oh. We lost her.
Uh-oh. Yep, we did.
Yep.
And I lost your video for a while. I haven't seen you for about 2 or 3 minutes.
We've been roboting. Can you not see me now? Oh, there it is. It's off. Yeah, it turned it off to conserve bandwidth, yeah. I guess.
See, that's what mine's been doing the last couple of times. Okay.
Yep. Do you remember the last thing she said?
No. We were talking about you know, if she ever got entertained by about redoing the field and making it artificial turf.
Yeah.
Going back.
Field was not performing as expected and as hoped from the college administrators.
Yeah,
so
that's
she
right.
was getting ready to make a comment about how that's odd.
Oh, yeah.
I think. We may have to turn our videos off to conserve bandwidth. I don't know what's going on over here.
Yeah.
Oh, Amy, are you there?
You just went off.
I just turned myself off.
Amy Fauti.
Is not available. Record your message
That's a terrible
after the tone.
Computer.
When you finish,
hang it up
you
and
can
try
hang
again.
Up or-
oh, it's not her. It's us. I'm going to hang up on you, call you both back.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Yvonne.
Hello, adding Amy.
Alrighty.
Nope, that's not Amy. That's my password.
That's a man down the street.
Okay. Oh, I probably should pause this.
That whole psych.
So here at Michigan State University, it was really important to the university administration that we keep with our agricultural tradition. And that meant for us to have grass in Spartan Stadium, being one of the first land-grant institutions in the country.
That's awesome.
It was really important that... you know, we maintain that tradition, agricultural upbringing, mm-hmm. land-grant institution upbringing. And for this university, our football stadium grass is the crown jewel that is agriculture here. And that is, you know, from the president on down. Everybody understands the sacrifices that we need to make to have that. And... you know, with that, it brings, you know, an incredible amount of responsibility to my staff and I as stewards of that.
Mm-hmm. So. You know, I wish more colleges would have that kind of thinking behind it. I think you guys are the only ones who've really thought that deeply into it. But, you know, you think about a lot of these other colleges that have shifted over to artificial turf. And, you know, I get it. I understand what's going on. In a lot of cases, it's just the demand for the surface, and the only way to be able to take it is by going to artificial turf. But as a turf guy, you know, it's just sad to see what's happen.
Well, and Amy's right, though, and I wish more of the land-grant schools would take this into mind. Your
yes.
entire university is based on growing plants for a living. You know, figure something else out instead of using artificial turf on what is likely your most viewed part of your entire campus.
Well,
there's so many ways to look at this, like you were just saying, Paul, is that, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which side of this argument that you look at, I mean, we're in the business of sports.
Right.
We're in the business of athletics.
Mm-hmm.
We're here, you know, stadiums are built to make money, right? They're mm-hmm. very expensive to sit empty, you know, because all you're doing is paying for repairs.
True.
You know, if it's sitting empty, you're not making money. So, you know, I understand kind of both sides of it. I do think that, in the past 10 years as far as sports turf managers go. I think the professionalism, the education, everything has come a long way. Not that there wasn't good ones before. I just think there are more good ones out there.
There's more
now.
Of them, right. Exactly.
Right, that can meet the expectation and levels and demands of just how diverse the sports turf manager's job is. You know, I always tell my guys, you know, you really need to be around here for 3 or 4 years before you really are a sports turf manager because, you know, you have to be a plumber, an electrician, facility manager, turf grass grower, a little bit of a politician, a purchasing agent. Like, you have to, you know, communications, external relations. You know, you have to have a little bit of an understanding of everything to do the job, especially at a university.
Good. Yep.
Is there, do you think there's anything that could have helped the turf management industry prevent the rapid progress of artificial turf in these football stadium settings?
You know, I think it was inevitable that artificial turf would creep back into the realm of sports. But, you know, there are places right now, what is it, Mississippi State's going to put grass back in upcoming years. You know, I just read you know, a really nice article in Sports Illustrated Online about how the top 12 of 30 fields voted
in the NFL
are all natural grass. So
and the majority of those were in the Bermuda grass areas. You know, in the southern areas, only two of them were bluegrass. Most of them, which that I understand too, because of course Bermuda grass can take the beating much better than bluegrass can, which makes your job even more amazing that you do there.
Thank you. But I just, you know, it can be done. And I think a lot of times it's more than what people want to worry about a lot of times. Because there's so much more planning and everything that needs to go into maintaining a natural grass field, especially a cool season field. I think that a lot of times administrators and folks just don't want to deal with the headache. And I, you know, because I understand what they're up against every day with coaches and politics, university stuff. I mean, you know, I get it. I get it. It's one less headache to have to worry about.
Well, and I always question the economics of it. You know, does it really add up? Because the argument is, well, it's cheaper to maintain than artificial turf. I mean, than natural turf. Artificial turf is cheaper to maintain. And but, you know, by the time you add the cost of putting in an artificial turf stadium and then realizing that 10 years down the line, you're going to have to redo it again.
Yeah, remove it, the cost of removing it and
replace
it. Another one. Yep.
You know, by the time you take all those costs and spread it out, I would say it's probably closer to a draw or maybe even a little bit more in the favor of natural turf. Now, again, where the downside is the amount of availability of field time that artificial turf gives you, of course, over natural turf. And that's, I think, where the issue comes up because the athletic directors are struggling to find time to fit all the activities that want to use that field, you know?
Absolutely. And just the headache. Okay. A couple of years ago, we had two games where we had back-to-back starting the season, we had to evacuate the stadium two games, two in a row. And that's and my boss has been in the business for 30 years, only had one stadium evacuation.
That's amazing.
In 30 years. And we had back-to-back stadium evacuations. And then, you know, dealing with just the way the field looked after that. It wasn't a matter of, you know, playability. We definitely had the playability necessary.
Sure.
But it was...
It's just the aesthetics.
Yeah. Right. You know, and thankfully for me here, you know, we've worked together with our coaching staff and our administrators and everybody that aesthetics is the fourth most important thing to an athletic surface, whether it's artificial, natural, hard surface. You know, we're looking at safety, playability, consistency of that surface, and then aesthetics.
Right, right. What? So can you explain real quickly for the listeners, when you say you had evacuations, just explain to them what you're talking about and why, and how why it affected your field the way it did.
Well, we had 75,000 people sitting, waiting for a game to start when we had lightning move into the area and severe storms. So all those folks, the teams, everybody had to be asked to evacuate Spartan Stadium. And then once you sit for a half an hour without lightning in the safety required amount of mileage, which I think they look at 5 to 10 miles, then everybody can come back in. So, you know, obviously with severe weather comes a lot of rain, sometimes hail. So the surface isn't playing. By the time you get back to the game, you're playing on a wet surface. Necessarily sloppy, but wet, which means, you know, you're obviously going to have more damage to that surface during the game.
Sure.
Yeah. Wet. Once you're wet, you're wet. I mean, it's not a matter of degrees after that point. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean we do a lot of tarping here. We've incorporated TDR technology into which is soil moisture content readings into all of our athletic fields. So we have a number that we associate with the field when it is at its best playability, whether it's a baseball skin, a softball skin, outfield grass at baseball. Pitch at soccer, the football stadium. We have certain numbers that we try to get to for that playability.
Interesting. So nobody was in the evacuation situations. They don't evacuate them off the field or anything through, you know, by walking off on the field, do they? It's all through the normal exits and whatnot.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to another subject. I know that you just had a big renovation of at least your baseball field. I don't know if your softball field went through it at the same time, but your baseball field just went through a big renovation, right?
Yes. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and why don't you tell us a little bit about it and tell us what all was done.
Okay, so over the past couple of years, we've had this idea. Wouldn't it be cool to install some sort of a heating system in our infield area at baseball as well as the skin area at softball? So to make it work for us, because actually our baseball and softball field are in a floodway and flood from time to time, very limited capacity for boilers or any sort of steam heat or anything like that. We installed the first of its kind in North America, an electric ribbon heating system. The ribbons lay flat. They're 2 inches wide by maybe a quarter inch thick, and they lay across the subsurface at whatever depth that you put them in. And then you put the skin or the root zone. They run under the mound, under the home plate area, everything, and radiate electric heat into those areas. For pictures of this, we have Michigan State University Athletic Fields Operation Facebook page, and we actually documented the entire process for people to view, because there was a lot of interest nationally about what we're doing here.
So what depth did you end up putting your ribbon in at? Do you know?
Under the skin areas, the ribbon is 4 inches, and under the grass, it is 8 inches, and it's all web based, so I can pull up an app on my surface, and I can see the area with a video camera, and I can set the temperature, and it'll operate like a thermostat.
So you can't wait for winter. You can't wait for winter to come, then, can you?
I'm really excited.
Yeah. You're gonna lay up.
I'm very excited.
You're gonna lay up there in bed at night. You're gonna lay up there in bed at night, playing on your little app. You know, okay, let's make it freeze. Now it's frozen. Let's make it thaw again.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, being, you know, this is new technology in North America. I mean, we've had people with cable heating. You know, this is the most efficient electric heat on the market now. This technology has not been used in North America, and this is actually it's a company out of the Netherlands, and, you know, this is the first baseball and softball field that they have done in the world. They have projects in Russia, projects in Australia, projects in Europe, but this is the first one in North America. So it was really, really cool to be able to team up with these folks and install these systems. And when you look at just installing it into softball, I mean, you're only looking at, and maybe this sounds funny, but you're only looking at $250,000 to install the system into the softball field. But compare that to installing a full artificial softball field. You're looking at at least twice as much money as that.
Yeah.
Sure.
So comparatively,
it's
more cost effective.
And allows you to stick to a natural surface that's going to be probably a little more player friendly, and the players are going to like playing on it. I mean,
absolutely.
It's a great answer. Now I just hope we get a really harsh winter so you can really test it out. But unfortunately, it probably doesn't look that way.
Well, you know, I'm actually hoping for kind of a mild winter so we can play with it a little bit. You know, I'm looking at, we didn't put this heat in the outfields at baseball and softball. It's from dugout to dugout to back of skin, basically, you know, to the backstop as well. So we heated that entire space. So gives our teams an opportunity to go out if the temperatures allow for us to, you know, these will all be things that we're figuring out. But they can go outside and at least take 20 minutes to ground balls. Or, you know, they can do some BP out there and see the ball come in from the pitching mound. I mean, people, you know, you understand this, Paul, because you've been around baseball. It's so different being in the cage and being inside and, you know, taking grounders than to be outside doing the same thing. And, you know, we're hoping that this will give our team a little bit more of a competitive edge again. Because, you know, we're just at such a disadvantage in the North. You know, 2/3 of our season's on the road. So
your baseball, you replaced the infield grass and I'm guessing the foul territory grass in too, since you had to put the heat under there, right?
Correct. Yep.
So when you came back with your soils after you buried your ribbon, did you stick with whatever native soil was there, or did you go with like a sand field, or what did you do?
Yeah, we have a really nice sandy loam natural soil on this field, so we stockpiled that material and then came back with it, and then we did a little searching, found some sod in Wisconsin that, you know, the soil matches were really nice. It's the way we want them. And we used that sod for these two projects.
Oh, good idea.
And we brought it in thick cut. I mean, we were playing on these two fields 14 days after they were complete.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So the team had
fall ball.
Yeah. So the team did get a chance to play on it before it got too cold out, I'm guessing.
Oh, they're still out there playing on it. Yeah, we've been playing on these fields since softball got started the Monday after Labor Day, and baseball started the following Friday after that.
So very cool.
Now it's October 15th. So, you know, we brought in a little bit thicker cut sod so that we could get out there. You know, the challenge has been just as the skin settles, you know, as the soil to skin areas start to settle, you know, we've been doing a lot of top dressing and a lot of extra dirt work in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been our, that's the challenge of, you know, starting to play on something 14 days after you put it in.
Have you been able to easily fit that into your schedule with football, knowing that you've had the heavier football schedule, or are you guys working some extra hours?
Well, we worked, we were quite a few extra hours those first couple weeks, mm-hmm. and I just cleared my schedule, and Andy and I have been working in Spartan Stadium while the rest of the staff was working more on these, finishing these projects, the little mm-hmm. details of the projects.
That's really cool.
It's always amazing to me how, you know, people don't always understand that when you finish a project, there's still a lot with something that's growing and living and settling and changing every day. They don't realize that you have another at least 2 months of detail work to really get it where you want it if you're a fussy field manager.
Yeah. Which most are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does your football field have heat under it, Amy?
It does not. Nope.
It does. Have you ever found a need for it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we definitely think about it. We don't exactly know the best way to look at that for the future, but that's going to be driven on whether the playoff system ends up expanding.
Sure.
Kind of the way the future of college football goes, I think, will drive any changes that get done in Spartan Stadium in the future. But right now, don't really see a need for it. You know, we're done Thanksgiving weekend, and though we still kind of battle that frozen surface, we found, you know, kind of, I call it old school NFL. We throw the tarps out there.
Sure.
We throw heaters, blow air. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just do it kind of old school.
Right.
And have a good time doing it. And that is, that's working for us right now.
Do you use any growth tarps on any of these fields during the fall?
Well, you know, I found since I've been at Michigan State that grow covers don't work real well for us here in the fall
mm-hmm.
because we just don't get the sunny days that I need to make them effective.
Well, that's true, actually. You're right. Now that I think about it, where you're located, especially if you start getting, you actually get lake effect clouds as you get into the colder period.
Yep.
Exactly.
That travels over there.
For the fall, I've never really found a real good value or even, you know, we put them on for the winter a few times as well.
Mm-hmm.
And all that I get to grow is Polania under those grow covers. So why do I want to do that?
Sure, sure.
The only time that we really, really find them useful is if they're predicting a winter that's going to be severely cold without a lot of snow cover. So we want to protect the field from desiccation. We have done that with good success. And then, you know, if we get into the springtime and sometimes we'll use grow covers maybe just down the middle or doing the goalie boxes at soccer, the infield grass at baseball, where you're helping the soil heat up. We've found them to be much more effective.
Well, Amy, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here. I'm a huge fan of yours and the work that you do. I think you do a tremendous job. And if anybody ever gets a chance to go up and see her field, her football field, especially in person, I mean, it is a work of art. And Amy, I can't thank you enough for being on the show today.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Any good Diamond Da Vinci knows that late summer and fall are the best time to get your ball fields ready for next season. Take advantage of the normally dry fall weather to prepare your field and facility so it's close to opening day ready by the time winter sets in. Avoid those wet spring conditions that can back you up against an opening day deadline. Here at Beacon Athletics, we're ready for your fall projects, be it mound and home plate renovations, infield skin overhauls, or larger projects like new net backstops, outdoor batting cages, dugouts, padding, or other facility amenities. Beacon has the products and the expertise to guide you through product and design choices. We'll work to help you get the best you can for the budget you have to spend on the project. Call us at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985. where our staff of experts are waiting to help you prepare for next season right now. Don't put off till tomorrow what you can do today. Do it now to make your spring easier.
Well, Paul, since we seem to be on a the winter cometh kick here at the Diamond Da Vinci's, I thought we should talk about turf blankets.
That's a good thing. Would you just pass me the electric blanket, please, because I'm freezing.
Hey, how cold did you get in Madison last night?
Actually, we're pretty warm. We were 40, but we're supposed what? To we're supposed to get a hard freeze tonight. We're going to be down the 20s, so makes me happy because I'm happy winter's coming.
I'm wearing my sweatshirt today. It's cold. It's awesome. I'm very excited.
It means I'm almost on the Little League fields for the winter, so I'm ready for my break.
Well, I thought we would walk through these, through the basics, and see where we end up. You and I always end up in fun different places, but I want to start first talking about the difference between a tarp and a blanket. I think, and let's see what you think, Paul. I think there are two major differences between a tarp and a blanket. Tarps are heavier. They tend to be 4 to 10 ounces, and that's, how is that measured? That's per square...
For square yard.
Yard. Okay. I was going to say meter, but I figured we're the United States. Of course, it's going to be yard. And turf blankets tend to be anywhere from 0.5 to 5 ounces. So there's a little bit of an overlap. But the next big difference will come down to what we call permeability. Whether or not the covering will allow light, water, moisture, atmospheric gases to pass through it. In general, in the case of tarp, they are impermeable. Although you will find that some people are marketing quote-unquote blankets that are impermeable. Yeah. Basically a tarp. Yeah. So that's really where I come out about those. When we start talking about blankets, there's a whole mess of... I use mess lightly, of different ways to create them. There are woven blankets. There are non-woven blankets, but they've been punctured in some way or another.
Needlepoint a lot of times, yep.
Yeah, or in some way they've been allowed to create a mesh-like structure. And you will also find what they call woven and coated. Where you'll have a woven blanket and there will be a coating on one or both sides to give it a different structure. And so you kind of got to think about what each of these do and how what they're letting through versus what your goal is. The other thing to keep in mind is that they are made of a bunch of different things, specifically the polys, polyethylene, polyester, and polypropylene.
Which is mostly what you're going to see out in the industry.
Yep. I did run across a university journal article that, and this is the first time I ever saw this, which is funny because it was done at the university where I went to school while I was there and I didn't realize it was going on. They talked about an aluminum mesh where presumably there was aluminum woven in with one of the polys. It didn't go into it. I couldn't find it online. I looked everywhere. No. So it must have been a test subject.
Yeah, safe to say I haven't seen it out in the industry. So
yeah.
Doesn't mean it's not there, but I haven't seen it.
Yep. But all of them are going to have, you know, basically the type of product that they use to create the blanket is going to give it different qualities as far as permeability for allowing the amount of sun in, whether it's 90%, 80%, 70%. Keeping heat in, keeping more heat or less heat in, allowing some moisture exchange, usually not a lot of moisture exchange. Unless you're looking at a seating blanket, which is 0.5 ounces to 1 ounce, you're not going to get a lot of moisture through there, but you will see some air exchange, which you want. You want that air exchange.
Yep.
Anybody who's left a tarp on their field for too long knows about how important air exchange can be.
Indeed.
So
we've all had that lesson taught to us once or twice.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
Yep. So, and that's unfortunately the most we can tell you about, because you can use a polyester tarp in the same, or poly, I said tarp. I fell for the trap. You can use there a polyester go. Blanket in much the same way as you can use a polypropylene blanket or a polyethylene blanket. You can use a woven in much the same way as a non-woven. A lot of it comes down to what you're using it for and what your experience with it is. For example, I was asking Larry about this because I wanted to know his experience, and he had fallen for a, fallen in love with, not fallen, got boondoggled on, a polypropylene non-woven blanket when he was back in Washington, D.C. He learned how to use it, and he likes it. So actually, this particular blanket is too thin for what he would like to use it for, so he bought two, and he doubles them up. He likes working with it. He knows how he can store it the best. He knows how he can deploy it the best. And so he's comfortable with it. And because he's in the major leagues, he can have that kind of flexibility with his budget.
Right.
So it can come down to a lot of different things as to how you're going to use these blankets to make your decision on which one you want to use.
Well, and I've never really... when I've used blankets, and I didn't use blankets hardly at all in Baltimore. We used them 1 year, and it was the year we had the Pope there. And I'm sorry, not the Pope. We had Major League Two was filming.
Ah.
And it came in late. They filmed till almost Thanksgiving.
Oh.
And they destroyed about 15,000 square feet of turf. I mean, just totally. There was nothing left of it.
Wow.
And so we stripped that turf and resodded it. And right after Thanksgiving, a hard freeze came. We put blankets down on them to try and hopefully extend some root growth. Because, you know, even though we got a hard frost doesn't last long, and you don't really get frost depth in Baltimore.
Yeah.
So we're going to try and get the roots going. But then what happened was... Mother Nature threw me a little bit of a curveball, and we got this really severe ice storm. Oh. And the severe ice storm covered the blanket, covered the turf, pretty much. And the problem was that all the areas I'm talking about were for the most part in our shade zone of the ballpark, which is along the first base side. So I had shade issues. I had the blankets that were layered in a heavy layer of ice, pretty much killing off most of that sod that we laid late that fall. So I can't really account for that experience except for the fact that it didn't work. Not because of the blankets, more so because of the ice.
Right.
But I have used them pretty extensively at the Little League fields. Now, the material we used in Baltimore, we're using the punch polyester fabric back then, that which most people don't even use anymore for blankets. That was the first blankets that came out were typically that punched polyester in the early days. Now you see mostly the woven polyethylenes and whatnot, and that's what I'm used to using at the Little League fields. And we use those every year in the fall, right after fall ball. We seed the really bad wear areas and put these covers on and leave them on for a month, basically. So by mid-November, we've got a full cover of grass where there was none, literally. There was no grass there. And then I like to pull it off and leave it off. I'm going to harden it off. And so we spend about a week taking it off, putting it on, taking it off, putting it on, letting the grass, because it's very succulent under there, will harden it off. And then usually after about a week's time, it's pretty well in pretty good shape to take most of what Mother Nature throws at it. And we've been pretty successful in that way. Some things I would change I'd like to use PGRs underneath there because, of course, you get extensive vertical growth and a blanket, that's a problem. And I don't really need the vertical growth at that time of the year. I want it to fill in and spread. So, you know, once the stuff comes up, if you are going to leave the blankets on all winter long, you want to put a plant growth regulator on there so that most of that energy is put towards the root zone and spreading the plant. Making the plants spread better. But the other thing is, of course, up in the north here, you got to worry more about snow mold under there. So certainly you want to make sure you're putting down snow mold treatments in that situation as well. So those are my experiences that I've had with those. But they're great for certainly great for late season germination, especially up here in the north. Mm-hmm. If you want to protect against winter desiccation, I've never really worried about winter desiccation, even when I was back in Baltimore. You know, in Baltimore before the first start of the season, we were already getting vertical growth, and I could cut that desiccation off. So, but in some situations, you know, you have to worry about the desiccation, and you know, you don't want that.
Yep.
Yeah, you don't want that ugly brown to be showing at the start of the season.
Yep.
There you got to worry about it more so than you do down the transition area of Baltimore.
Yeah.
Which is probably the primary reason I would imagine that Larry covers his.
It is. Yeah, the number one reason is desiccation. Because we do get some good winds and we do get some very, very cold temperatures, which I know you do in Wisconsin as well. But you guys actually tend to get a little bit more snow than we do. And being in the cities, especially, we get a little less snow than even some of our surrounding areas. And so desiccation can be a real issue here. And there's that weird balance. You mentioned it, vernalization, of letting the grass harden off, as we call it, or vernalize, go dormant for the winter, and get its protective antifreeze products is really what they are. As a physiologist, that's really kind of how we think about them, as their antifreeze. Get all of that built up inside of its system so that it's better ready to handle, you know, whatever's going to happen to it. And actually, there's some argument, and that's a whole nother turf science segment, so I should probably just shut up, but there's a whole argument about how cool season grasses grow better when they're allowed to vernalize. It's a whole different subject. But you do want them to have that hardiness. So there's a balance between keeping the blankets off long enough, getting them on soon enough, and then getting them off soon enough so they can start getting the light that they need, while also putting them back on at night, especially this far north, because we will still get some pretty severe frost all the way into May. So it's a fun little dance, plus snow removal and all that other stuff. And, you know, you and I mentioned it, and I'll be talking to my clients about it. And Larry and I talked about it last night. This is going to be a fun year, and we're currently anticipating that blankets that are used up in the north will have to be removed at least once, if not twice, just for fungicide applications. And that may require snow removal, but we're betting that the snow is going to melt. And that we'll be able to just remove them and apply the fungicides. Because that is a real issue. And it's actually an issue down south as well. You leave these blankets on too long, it gets too warm under there or too moist under there. And down south, you can get rhizoctonia in the middle of winter, which doesn't happen. That's a warm season disease. But if it gets warm enough and you haven't taken those blankets off, you can see some rhizoctonia. So if you've not used blankets before, you know... I highly recommend talking to an agronomist or a consultant or a really good friend in the industry who has used them before, because there is a special dance. Same thing with warm season grasses. There's that fun dance of you want your Bermuda grass or your seashore pass pallum, you know, you want to keep it green longer, but not too much longer because you need it to harden off also so it doesn't winter kill if you're too far north or if you're too far south so it doesn't get the rhizoctonia. But you also need to get the blankets off soon enough so it can start to wake up, because that's the other part of this that a lot of people don't think about, is you don't want to wake up the grass too early, because it will use up all of its nutrient reserves before it's ready to actually start photosynthesizing. And that can be just as dangerous.
That's an excellent point.
And you will see, and I've seen it happen on fields where I was an employee, you know, just fresh out of turf school, where we would have the blankets on to get that green color nice and early, because transition zone, and we'd have this beautiful flush of growth, and then all of a sudden the field would look like crap. I mean, awful, when it should be looking its absolute best for a good 3 weeks, because we had used up all of our reserves before the grass was ready to start photosynthesizing.
It is amazing how much heat can build up, especially in the transition zone on south, how much heat can build up under those blankets. I mean, they're a true greenhouse, and they really do an incredible job of bringing the heat up. So you do have to be careful with that, like you say, with the Bermuda grass, probably more so than you do with the blue and the cool season grasses here.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about here, but we're kind of running out of time. So I will leave with one note. I found an article through the Michigan State Turf Archive called "Do Your Athletic Fields Need Turf Blankets?" It was written in 2006 by Jim Herman, CSFM. He's actually apparently out of New Jersey. I'm not sure if he's a consultant, and I'm not sure if he's still active. I couldn't find a website. And I also couldn't find which publication this article had come out of. But we will have a direct link to the article. It's a PDF, one page, exceptionally well written. I was very impressed with it. And what I like the most about it is that he had a very good rundown of things to be cautious about. You know, the preventative fungicide, like we talked about, what can happen with different frosts, your mowing program, how the turf is going to be more, like Paul said, succulent and a little bit more sensitive when it comes out of the blankets, and some different ideas that you can use to prepare yourself for your first time if you've not used the blankets. And as a final word, I would also say some people will recommend to use a grommet when you are placing your sod staples down to secure the blankets. Those grommets are going to get lost. There's no way of getting around that. If it doesn't come with grommets, then next best thing, or I think a better option if the blanket doesn't come with tape and grommet on it, is to fold the blanket over a few times, because you don't want to go chasing grommets around your field and listening to them plink up into your mower that you have just recently backlapped and adjusted, because ouch.
you just have to get better growth tarps that have good grommets in, like ours here at Beacon.
Well,
little commercial there.
Well, if you're looking,
I've never
you
had
know
that issue.
Yeah, a lot of people don't have that issue. I'm coming from a transition zone where we used what they call tobacco seed covers. They're Remay growth cloths. Yep. Those are the 1/2 ounce to 1 ounce cloths, and those do not come with grommets. They're like tissue paper. You can't push snow off of them, but they are very useful for what they do.
Well, and that with that final note, that pretty much puts this show in the books. Be sure to tune in next time to Diamond Vinci's for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is it's all free, you see, because that's the kind of deal we're going to strike up for you.
The official website can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes and any links and photos that we discussed during the episode. We also still have our pictures and bios up there in case you're curious
still,
about who
yes.
you're listening to and just how dorky we are. Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments on our show, good or bad. If you have show ideas, make sure you send them along to us. We do listen to those ideas. We've had some sent to us already, and we're incorporating those into our future shows. So, yes, we do listen to what you folks send to us, so get that to us. Also, if you're listening on iTunes, please, 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 please do a review of the show for us on iTunes. We beg of you. We'd like to see those reviews coming in, so keep them coming.
And if you happen to be on Twitter, go ahead and give us a follow over at Diamond Da Vinci's. That's at Diamond DAVINCIS. Not crazy active there, but it's a good way to keep up with what we're doing on the show.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I'm out of here.
Adios, guys.